Returning now to Paul's testimony, his first letter, second chapter. He begins the second chapter with these lies. Later, through 14 years also, I went up to Jerusalem along with Barnabas, having taken along also Titus. I went up, but then downwards from an uncovering, to set forth to them the beneficial messenger, which I preach among the races down from one's own. You know, it's amazing that the terms that Paul chose, that he set forth, that he set up his presentation, which is what you do if you're going to convince people of a story of something that's not true. And of course, this wasn't the beneficial messenger which all of those in Jerusalem witnessed. Paul had to present his own. It's the beneficial messenger which I preach, according to one's own and unique perspective, is what Paul wrote. He's confessed every which way to his scribe. Now, as we're discovering, the epistle to the Galatians was Paul's attempt to reestablish his tattered reputation, one that had been called into question because he alone, among those claiming to speak for God, was willing to contradict God. He, therefore, put himself in a position where the only way he could appear credible while contradicting God would be to tell everyone who would listen to him that his message had been approved and endorsed by Yahusha's disciples, specifically Shimon, Jacob, and Yohanan. If he could get them to say, yeah, what he's saying is all true, then that would at least give him a shred of credibility. But they wouldn't. They didn't. If it were prudent to believe Paul, if there was any chance that what he was saying was true, you know, they might have given it to him, but they didn't. And most certainly, Paul sought to repudiate them. You know, the only reasonable way to look at what we read in Galatians and in Acts is that Paul sought their approval, did not get it, and demeaned them as a result. He would then write, but then to one's opinions, not somehow perhaps too foolishly and stupidly, I might run, or I ran. I know that doesn't make any sense. It's Galatians 2:2, by the way. It's the completion of 2:2. But then to one's opinions, dokiai, presumptions and suppositions, not somehow perhaps too foolishly and stupidly, kinos, without purpose and falsely, for nothing and vainly, I might run. Treko, I might have run in haste, was written in the present tense, which portrays an action in process with no assessment of its completion, and the active voice, which signifies that Paul is doing the running, and the subjunctive mood, which presents the action as a mere possibility. Or I ran. That was the aorist active indicative, which conveys a moment in the past performed by the speaker, in this case, Paul. I've given you all the information that there is to be gleaned. And I'm telling you, folks, you can't make sense of this. This is nearly incomprehensible. So let's confer with an Esley Allen Greek New Testament 27th edition with McReynolds English Interlinear to ascertain whether this is what Paul actually wrote. And they scribed, published, but to the ones thinking not perhaps an empty I might run or I ran. So folks, I suspect the problem is with the quality of the writing rather than with the merits of the translations. Now, plunging deeper into the words themselves, this is the first of five times that we will confront dokiai. Its opinion is a simple way to write it. It's the opinion of someone. It means to suppose or to presume. It means to hold an opinion based upon appearances. It's not a good word. If you're talking about trying to differentiate who's telling the truth about Yahweh, about Yahusha, if you're talking about, is someone presenting Yahweh's testimony from his Torah, prophets, and Psalms accurately or inaccurately, if you're talking about your mission in life, which is to convey what God has said to us, of the words that you could pick as to whether or not you were or were not doing that job honestly and appropriately and accurately, dokia would be a horrible choice. Because it, like faith, isn't about fact, it's about opinion. It means to suppose and to presume. Dokia conveys the idea of wanting to see someone or something a certain way, or of someone being predisposed to a certain viewpoint. It is not flattering. It is not reassuring. And because it is not thoughtful, it is not a ringing endorsement. If this is to be thrust into the lips of the disciples and to be their evaluation of Paul, and the best Paul could say was, but to the ones' opinions, the ones making suppositions and presumptions, not perhaps in vanity, I might run or I ran, it is the farthest thing possible from a ringing endorsement. Cutting to the chase, dokia conveys a subjective opinion as opposed to an objective conclusion. So in the context of an endorsement on a topic which is literally life and death, and one so easily verified by way of the undisputed standard, Yahweh's Torah, this is a glaring red flag. And it gets far worse in context. Because in addition to the presumptuousness of dokai, we must add to this thought the somehow and perhaps aspects of pos. Further, the standard Paul is claiming to have vested was kinos, stupidity and foolishness. Even if I wouldn't accuse Paul, I said, even I wouldn't accuse Paul of being stupid. False and vain, well, that's another story. But stupid? No, he's not stupid. He's insane. He's demon-possessed. He's a pathological liar. He is amongst the most despicable people who's ever lived. But he's not stupid. Immoral, but not stupid. Irrational, but not stupid. And that was what he was saying. He says, you know, they supposed, their opinion was that I wasn't foolish and stupid. I might not have been foolish and stupid. Okay, that's quite an assessment. As weak as this supposed endorsement appears, there are reasons to suspect that Paul's tepid assessment may not even be accurate, or at the very least, it may be purposefully misleading. There is another account, one more credible and detailed than this, expressing what actually occurred during this meeting. And that is why this may be what politicians would call spin, as opposed to an outright lie. In that light, this is not actually an endorsement of Paul, his message, or his mission. This is more of an indication that something was seriously wrong. opinions, not somehow perhaps to foolishly and stupidly I might run or I ran. Even if we could figure out the rest, this still doesn't say what he was running to, for, or from. In that Protestant Christianity is predicated in large part on the King James Bible's interpretation of Paul's theology, it's incumbent upon us to compare these texts. Now, recognizing that Paul actually wrote, I went up, but then downward from uncovering and unveiling which lays bare, laying down to them the beneficial messenger which I preach among the races from one's own and unique, separate perspective. But then to the opinions and presumptions, not somehow perhaps into foolishness, into stupidity, without purpose and falsely, I might run, or I ran. Now there is no basis in this for gospel, for privately, or which were of reputation, and yet this is what we find in the King James. And I went up by revelation, and communicated unto them that gospel which I preach among the Gentiles, but privately to them which were of reputation, lest by any means I should run or had run in vain. Now, should this be accurate, why would Paul consider running from them? Had he come to visit with them, after all? And it had been he who had persecuted them, not the other way around. Further, should Paul have actually been inspired by Yahweh, he would have known that God's message is never in vain, only man's. So if he is attributed saying these things, then Paul is providing us with a window into the origin of his message. The only way that a message would be questioned as to being stupid or vain is if it is of human origin. God's message is never stupid, and it never fails. We'll be back. Before we continue, we have the second coming of Larry on the line. I have seen him from the wilderness.
Yeah,
not citing Dionysus, but hi, Larry.
Yeah, I just posted about the wilderness. It's such a funny thing, you know, where Yahusha says, you know, if any guy comes to you and he talks about the fact he's been with me out in the wilderness, don't believe this guy's a liar.
Right.
Of course, he was talking to the disciples. That's the only guy that ever did this was Paulos, you know.
Yeah. So, you know what's amazing, yeah, too, is that twice Yahusha tells his disciples that this con man, the wolf in sheep's clothing, and this the individual that claims to have seen him in the wilderness before everybody sees him return all at once, that he says that he will fool even the chosen.
Yeah.
Well, it means there were some of the disciples that Paul fooled. And Paul was a lot of things, but stupid wasn't one of them. He was a horrible writer, but he was a bully too. Yeah, I think so. I think he was a bully. I think he had that kind of persona that was very difficult for people to confront.
Well, yeah, because I mean, he took Jacob and threw him down a flight of stairs, if you're to believe the disciple
Clint.
of Shimon, which
right.
I
Clint.
Do.
Yeah,
yeah, I absolutely believe him. He thought he had murdered Jacob and was happy about it.
Yeah,
know,
that particular Clement homily, the Clement testimony, the only fly in the ointment there, and I didn't include it in questioning Paul, because while it is obvious when you study the timeline and the characters involved that Clement is writing about Paul.
Oh yeah.
He uses a pseudonym for Paul. And so in the actual text, it does not say that Paul threw Yaakov down a flight of stairs and thought him dead. The actual text says that something Simon Marcus, or it's got a pen name for Paul.
Yeah, of course. The only thing we have is the Vulgate, and all they did was copy edited out Paul.
I know. Yeah, that's great. That's very possible that that is the case. When I read it, and someone pointed it out to me years ago, and I read the whole thing, I was convinced that Clement knew what he was talking about, was an eyewitness on the scene, and had correctly communicated Paul's egregious behavior. The reason I did not include it, I'm glad that you brought it up, because I think it's a legitimate testimony, and I think it's accurate, and I think it helps fill in some of the voids that we don't have. The reason I did not include it was twofold. One is that it takes some time to explain because he doesn't actually use Paul's name, at least in the surviving copy. And second, Paul's own testimony is so internally contradictory, so erroneous, so faulty, that Paul hangs himself with his every word. And so if you just compare Paul's words to Yahweh's and Yahusha's testimony and to reason, and even compare Paul's words to Paul's words, you can drive 1,000 nails in this man's coffin.
Oh, yeah. It's not like you need that. It's just kind of an interesting aside. But since you're talking about the wolf, Yahweh said this about the wolf in Bereshit. He said, Benjamin viciously tears apart, mangles, kills, and devours like a wolf.
Right.
Benjamin. Then over here in Romans 11:1, this is what Paul says. I say, therefore, that God has not pushed away, rejected, or repudiated his people. May it never be, for indeed I am an Israelite from the seed of Abraham, from the tribe of Benjamin. That's the wolf.
Yeah.
He's a wolf that tears apart. I mean, boy, talk about connecting the dots here.
Yeah, but by the way,
that's what we're supposed to do, by the way.
Oh, that's what we're supposed to do. That's, in fact, the Hebrew word for understand is bien. And bien means to connect, to make a connection between things. The Hebrew verb conveying understanding actually tells us to connect the dots, to make connections between things. The biggest connection, of course, there are two others with the wolf. One is that Yahusha, describing the wolf in sheep's clothing, does so in a context that the only candidate is Paul. When you listen to the context of his presentation
in
Matanyah at the conclusion of the Sermon on the Mount, you're left with a single candidate. In all of human history, there's only one person that meets the qualifications of the wolf in sheep's clothing. That's Paul. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Larry about some of the prophecies condemning Paul. It's interesting in the one with where Yahusha is talking about the wolf in sheep's clothing, that Yahusha actually uses a derivative of harp. It's translated, whatever the Hebrew word. They both were to use the Hebrew word, but a derivative of the Greek word harpazo is attributed to him.
How that
wolf is going to rip the souls to shreds by leading them away from the Torah. I mean, it's the means to be vicious is to lead people away from the Torah, and Paul's the only one that did that. The only person ever to speak for God that leads people away from the Torah in human history of any consequence is Paul. And he uses harpazo. Now, harpazo is Paul's most famous term. And for those that don't know it, the reason harpazo is his most famous term is Paul's only prophecy. The only thing that Christians ever talk about in eschatology regarding Paul from a prophetic point of view is based on harpazo. The harpazo is transferred raptus into Latin and rapture into English. So the rapture is vicious snatching away of souls.
You know, yesterday I did a pretty entertaining post and got some really good answers, by the way.
Okay.
And this is kind of off the pall, but it is on shattering myths. And the post read like this. Okay, there's a lot of religious myths that are advanced out of the traditions of religion. The delusion that really bothers me the most is that God is everywhere, followed closely by God loves everyone. Okay? you should hear some of these. It's actually beautiful.
I have a third one that I would like to add to that, third one and a fourth one that they're really in the same vein. God knows everything.
Uh-huh.
God knows everything, and that God is involved in all aspects of our lives.
Yes, these are all in there, by the way. You know, I have different people posting. The myth that deceased loved ones are watching over you.
No, it's amazing. But most Christians, they go to funerals or they'll talk, and I said, "Oh yeah, I know so and so. Yeah, he's up in heaven. He was looking down on me, and I know he's proud of me." Yeah, right. First of all, your loved one is not in heaven, and second of all, if they could look upon this world, they would not be pleased. They would be disgusted. That's the reason why in heaven, the last thing we're going to be able to see is the... Right. Right. Exactly. Oh, my God.
Dwayne Longhofer, he writes, "Don't worry, God is in control."
Yeah, that's why we have free will.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
God's in such control that all those buildings burned down and the stores were looted in Ferguson because God was in control.
Right. Yeah, he was controlling all that. Sure.
Yeah, I'm quite sure that Leia, the daughter of the NFL player, I think from Cincinnati, that has cancer. God gave her cancer so that the NFL could show that it has a heart.
Yeah, Dawana Powers wrote, this one drives her crazy. The delusion of everything is God's will.
Oh, yeah, no matter. By the way, that is predominant in Islam. Everything begins and ends with Allah willing, inshallah. But the fact is, God's really narrow on his will. He states what his will is. It's a very succinct objective. And 99.9% of what man does and what man says and what happens to humanity is either opposed to or has no bearing on it. So I'm going to tell you, it isn't God's will.
Well, I got one down here that just says, touchdown.
Yeah, touchdown. Yeah, Tebow. You know, it's amazing how many they interviewed evangelical Christians when Tim Tebow was winning football games. And he was presented, you know, front cover of magazines as God's quarterback. And 75% of evangelical Christians actually believe that God influenced things on behalf of Tim Tebow to make Tim Tebow a national representative for Christianity.
What happened and of course, when he went pro?
Tim Tebow. Yeah, what was so funny is that after the Denver experience, where he was more lucky than anything else, but after the Denver experience, there's not a single team that would hire him as a quarterback. I mean, he's in the broadcast booth right now as a color analyst on SEC football games. So if God was influencing Tebow's play and others' play to make Tebow look good, then I got to tell you, God's a pretty inept quarterback coach.
Here's a good one. Martha Masterson writes, "God doesn't want me to judge." Don't use your head. Don't think about things. Don't really judge all things against the Torah. Don't try all spirits with that method. Just don't judge. I guess
just
be an idiot. You know.
Why have free will if we're not going to exercise good judgment? What's the purpose of choice if you can't make good choices? How does one become moral if one can't be judgmental?
Because you're allowed to be wrong. You're allowed to be wrong.
How do you be? How can you be just without being judgmental?
Well, you're allowed to be wrong. I mean, there's nothing. There is nothing wrong. Like, there's nothing bad that happens to you if you just go throughout your life, and you're just wrong, and you don't mislead anybody else, and you don't try and push what you think on other people. I mean,
yeah, but if you exercise good judgment, you could come out of life with better than a no net loss, no net gain. I mean, I would prefer to use good judgment and to come out of life with a net gain. How about you?
Well, yeah, but I mean, you don't have to come. You don't have to get to know him as long as you don't lead other people astray.
That's true. Just the end of your life, it's over.
That's your choice.
That's the consequence of that choice.
It doesn't sound very funny.
This idea that we shouldn't be judgmental to me is just so asinine. That means that there's no reason to think. We should observe, but not respond in a rational way. You know, if we're not to be judgmental, what's the purpose of not bearing false witness? What's the purpose of saying that you shouldn't kill on an ongoing basis? Isn't God being judgmental? Is it wrong to say that the rioters and looters in Ferguson did something they should not have done, or am I being judgmental?
No, you would be following the Torah. The Torah is, you know, one of the, I heard you once say this, and I really gave it a lot of thought, Yada. You were talking about really the worst thing, you know, that people can do, you know, besides attaching religion to Yahweh, is stealing. That's the one that's done the greatest harm, theft. And by and large, when you think of it on a micro or macro scale, either way, that is correct. That's what's done the most harm to society. And so when we see people that are just breaking the Torah all over the place, right down to they want to change a system, a Babylonian system, and somehow make it perfect, actually make it to where it benefits them. These are the things that, you know, we should, you know, stand up against.
Can I correct you on something here?
Go ahead.
I would not have taken this view until probably this very moment.
Okay.
I'm not so sure that America is a broken Babylonian system. I think it's a broken Roman. I think it's a broken Roman system.
Oh, well, thank you.
Now, let me tell you why I would distinguish the two.
Okay.
And clearly, the Babylonian politic and militarism and religion grew out of Babylon. We know the connections between the two.
Yahweh, through
Daniel, actually presented the connection between these beasts. But of the Roman beast, Yahweh was especially condemning. I mean, he went way out of his way to say, Rome is the most vicious of all beasts, that there's nothing that compares to Rome, and that the beast of Rome doesn't die.
Yeah, it'd be the hardest to get rid of. Yeah,
it mauls and influences the entire world. And when you look at how many American institutions are Roman, and how
the majority of the big ones. Yeah.
Oh, the majority of the big ones. I mean, our architecture in Washington is Roman. Our Senate is Roman. Our president being commander in chief is Roman. Our
many
national
of the
emblem, the
teams
eagle,
are owned by Knights of Malta members, on and on. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. We are hugely Roman. In fact,
they have a red, white, and a blue mass. Imagine that.
Oh, yeah.
Huh?
Absolutely. And you go back, and Rome was the only legitimate nation republic. And America, you know, fashions itself a republic. I mean, we really are Roman, and we're a nation influencing in a negative way, really, the whole world. We are, with the biggest military, we are the most belligerent country on earth, most deadly country on earth. I think we are a Roman nation, and according to God, Rome is never fixed. It's never repaired. It's never improved. You can't fix it, which is why you got to walk away from it. So all of these politicians and all these people standing up and saying, we have a problem that we need to fix. We have a problem. It can't be fixed.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's laughable. I mean, I said Babylonian, but it was the Romans that adopted a lot of the Babylonian nonsense into their religion and then foisted it out there on the world and used it as a control mechanism and really robbed the world blind for the last 2,000 years and still are to this day.
In fact, I can get to transition us right back to Paul. Speaking of the Roman system, what book, to whom was his audience? What was Paul's audience? What nation was he writing about and to when he told all that would believe him that we should submit to our government and that God appointed all governments for our good, for us to obey? What book would you find that in, Larry?
Well, I believe that's Romans.
That is correct.
Yeah,
of the most vicious beast, the most negative influence on humanity, because the Daniel prophecy is a swath of all time, and it talks about the most egregious influences on humankind. And what God says is that Rome was and is the worst, the most anti-Torah, the most adverse to him, the most deadly. And Paul was saying, oh, it's godly. Submit to him. Well, one of the two was lying. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. You know, it was interesting, Larry. I was reading an article from Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz, I guess his father was a senator. His comments were that his dad affirms that God is not finished with America, and that Rafael Cruz, the preacher and the father and father to Senator Ted Cruz, said it's high time for Christians to rally, to take back the nation from atheist progressives, but to take to heart that God is still in charge. He specifically drew attention to abortion as problematic in God's eyes and said in an interview that the blood of 57 million babies is crying out to God. So, as I read that, that's because we were just talking about Paul's letter to the Romans and about Rome and saying that every government was established by God and you should submit to them. So how could Rafael Cruz be a Christian preacher and tell Christians they need to take back their government? Did God fail? Was God absent?
Obviously he did. I mean, if he was in charge and he was steering this entire boat and beating it ashore.
No, that's what Paul said. Paul said that God established the government and we should all submit to it. Why would we? Why would Christians then take it back?
Well,
who are they taking it back from? From God?
Christians' whole belief is based around God failed.
Yeah, by the way,
a New Testament. He told my old ways. That was wrong before. I didn't mean to be like that. I got to be like this now. And
he says that God is still in charge. If God's still in charge, then why do Christians have to take the government back?
Hey, well, I mean, that's a good point. And I want to look at Hosea, better known today as Hosea 8:4. And this is what God said, in case his words might matter. They have set up kings, but not by me. They made princes. I knew them not. Of their silver and their gold, they made them idols that they may be cut off. That means die, by the way.
That's correct.
And then Paul over here says, let us be in subjection to the government authorities. There is no authority except from God. The authorities that exist are appointed by God. So he's in direct opposition there
to
God.
Right.
Now,
and then he goes on talking about abortion is the biggest problem in God's eyes. Where does God tell us that abortion is the biggest problem? I mean, he's got his top 10 list.
That don't
of
make
issues,
the list, pal.
You know, abortion doesn't make that top 10 list. So, I'm sorry. No, abortion is not on the top 10 list. And then it says the blood of 57 million babies is crying out. Have you ever heard blood talk?
Never have. Aware of. I've never heard a dead person talk, but that's just me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
You know, listen, I think abortion is a really bad idea. And that there are so many better options than abortion. Like, One is, if you're not married and are not in a position to give birth and raise children, don't have children. I mean, that'd be first and foremost. And if you're going to have sex with somebody that you're not married to, that you're not prepared to have children with, then use contraceptive. And if you then screw up those two things and you get a girl pregnant, then put that child up for adoption if you're not prepared to raise it. Killing it really is not high on the list of that's a really good choice.
I think it goes back into the whole don't make a habit out of it.
Don't make a habit out of it.
You need to do it.
But I mean, is God probably disappointed in America for legalizing the murder of 57 million unborn babies?
Yeah, it wouldn't be very Torah appropriate.
Right. But if he was in control, which this guy seems to think, how did that happen? How did that happen if God's in control?
Well, obviously he isn't in control because there's a thing called free will.
Right. Isn't the law of the land of America that you can't restrict abortion?
That's right.
Then when Paul wrote that you subject to the authorities, they're put in place by God for you, that God is in charge, somebody is not telling the truth here. Either that or this God is really not very effective. You know, I wonder what these guys ever bother to think through what they say. I mean, you just read this and it's laughable. And yet, this individual made the Washington Times. Good grief. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks, Larry.